listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the past few years, cyber attacks and viruses like Stuxnet have made international headlines, but they represent just the most visible part of ongoing cyber warfare, in which attacks, many of which we never hear about, take place on servers using sophisticated code. Joining me now to talk about where the battle lines are drawn is Michael Joseph Gross. His article, Silent War, is in the July issue of Vanity Fair, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Hey, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
You say cyberspace has become a battlefield now, but it's one that's shrouded in secrecy, isn't it? Since they're an open secret, do we have any idea of the scope of these attacks?
Yes, we begin to put together a large picture of what's going on. My whole goal in writing this story was to take what had been a jumble of helter-skelter facts that had sprinkled across the business pages and tech pages about various cyber attacks and try to place them in a larger coherent narrative. This matters because Washington is trying to keep U.S. cyber operations even more secret than the drone program, even though the impact of cyber war is broader and potentially more devastating.
Do we only hear about them after the fact if someone claims credit?
Absolutely, because most of the time, all of the events connected to a cyber attack are immediately classified as soon as they're known.
On the other hand, when the United States claims that a lot of cyber attacks have come from China, the Chinese just simply deny that that's the case.
That's true, and we do the same thing.
should we assume that the Chinese are just lying and that we're just lying?
Well, unfortunately, the climate of secrecy has created a situation where that assumption does seem to be the most reasonable one. Unfortunately, we have in so many ways now contravened our own ideals, legitimized the use of cyber attacks outside the context of open warfare, that a presumption of guilt instead of a presumption of innocence would seem to be the wiser tack.
And it's also, isn't it also difficult to complain that you're being attacked when it's obvious that you're doing the same sort of thing? The latest Snowden revelations have made it very hard for the United States to be critical of China.
Now, the question brings me to one of the first points that I'd hope to make in this conversation, which concerns the difficulty of having conversations about cybersecurity in general. Unfortunately, it's such a big amorphous issue and something that so few people know anything about that we begin to lump all kinds of attacks together, when in fact, I think the main work that people like you and me have to do right now is to try to begin to draw the lines around the conversation and distinguish among these kinds of attacks so we can start to figure out how to discern the rules and solve the problems.
Well, we've compared nuclear proliferation with the current situation of cyber attacks, but you pretty much knew who was building bombs. If anybody would send missiles off, you could pretty much find out the source from the start. What about here? And what about rules of engagement? As cyber attacks have become more common, have there been any rules of engagement that have developed?
Very few to our knowledge. A couple of other points of contrast between nuclear proliferation and cyber proliferation, going beyond what you just mentioned. Nuclear weapons, very difficult to build, requiring material that is expensive and that can be tracked. And most critically, their use is limited by clear deterrence. You know, since World War II, we have never used, no country has used a nuclear bomb.
Well, there's mutually assured destruction, but that doesn't apply with cyber warfare. That's
right, because cyber weapons are so easy to build. One of the main points of the story, or one of the main strands of the narrative, concerns an individual hacker, a guy named Wes Brown, who was sitting in a Dunkin' Donuts coffee shop in Maine one winter, and he was working with one of his friends trying to figure out a presentation at a hacker conference that he could use for self-promotion. What he came up with was a new piece of malicious software that offered a revolutionary model of cyber espionage. And even though he, as far as he knew, there were no government people in the audience, a couple of years later, it turned out that that very same model was used in an operation called Flame, which appears to have come from the U.S. and or Israel, or interests aligned with the United States. And it operated in exactly the same way. So in the end, what Wes said to me was, he saw this and it was confirmation to him, you don't have to be a nation state to do this. You just have to be really smart.
Well, much of your article focuses on Iran. So there are rather sophisticated hackers working in Iran?
There are.
Are there certain countries that tend to have more sophisticated hackers than others?
There are. Yes, there are. But to go back to your first question, this story is about the conflict between cyber attacks that advance U.S. interests on the one hand and Iranian interests on the other. Now, there is some evidence presented in the article that attacks such as those on the U.S. banking system, which began last September in deadly earnest, if they didn't come directly from Iran, it seems that they are so closely aligned with Iranian interests and in so many ways, that even if they're getting some help from people like from hackers in China or hackers in Russia or hackers in Syria, they are moving the ball down the field in a way that is very much working for Iran.
My guest is Michael Joseph Gross, whose article Silent War is in the July issue of Vanity Fair. Well, the group calling itself Is ad-Din al-Qassam, claims to be a Sunni jihadist group, took responsibility for those bank hacks, didn't they? Iran is a majority Shiite country. Is that an attempt to mislead us, or could Sunnis also be working in Iran?
It certainly appeared to the best intelligence analysts I spoke with that it was what they call a false flag. Nothing about, let's just call them Qasem for short, nothing about Qasem really made sense. Even the name, the full name that you just read, is the name of a cleric who has no meaning for Sunnis. It's the language that they used had never been seen in Sunni jihadist forums. And so,
well, at least five banks had their sites knocked out by a surge of manufactured traffic. Isn't that kind of attack using distributed denial of service fairly primitive?
Yes, it is.
So what is the goal then?
Well, several goals. Though it is primitive, it is still effective. And in this case, it was like a regular denial of service on steroids. What they did was to a normal DDoS, like the difference between parking a jam in a parking lot at the mall and a full-on road rage-inducing traffic jam in L.A. on Memorial Day weekend. What happened was they knocked out the service. They also managed to knock out internally communications at the bank, which had more far-reaching and lengthy impact than was ever made public.
Well, why do people think it went back to Iran? Why Iran? Well, why are they going after these banks?
Oh. These banks are, they lie at the core of the global financial infrastructure. This is a way for them to fire a pistol in the air. Or as one former CIA official told me, it's like the fingernail full of cocaine that the dealer gives you to show you that it's the real thing. This was a way to get at the United States where they know that it could hurt us without doing enough actual damage to poke the giant in the eye and make us come back at them.
So officials say that even though it looks like a fairly primitive attack, it's actually pretty sophisticated?
Well, in certain ways, it was more... good point.
You said they're just showing us that they could do it.
Technically, it was amped up as a psychological operation. It was very sophisticated. If you are trying to tell the giant that you can get him, you're just going to show him that you can point the gun at his head. You're just going to make him sweat. You're just going to make him scared. And that is certainly what they did. Because even though these attacks were not, so far as anyone knows, extremely effective in bottom-line financial terms, what they did was to create headlines that showed American vulnerability at a time when America wanted to demonstrate strength, particularly in negotiations with Iran over its nuclear program.
What happened when PNC Bank CEO James Rohr publicly commented on the attack on his bank's site?
If you have the quote in front of you, read it.
I don't have the quote.
It's a good one. He was the only CEO of a victim bank who spoke out, and immediately afterward, the attacks intensified. And from then on, no senior executive at any bank has publicly spoken out.
The banks and telecoms are bearing the cost of these attacks. Has the U.S. government tried to work with those corporations to help them protect themselves better?
We don't know much about what exactly the government is doing. We do know that there's a lot of paralysis and hand-wringing and uncertainty about what they can or should do. And we do know that that's making some of the leaders in the financial industry just furious because they feel that they are being forced to pay an unlegislated tax, effectively, in support of U.S. covert operations against Iran.
Who claimed responsibility for the attack on Saudi Arabia's Aramco main computer network in August of last year? Was that also Iran?
That was a group of hackers who, previously unknown if memory serves, called the Cutting Sword of Justice.
Good names.
Very good names. And they had quite a dramatic flair about them. They went in and just devastated the data, erased it on 3/4 of the machines of the main computer network of Saudi Aramco. In place of the data that they destroyed as a kind of calling card, they lit up the screen of all the machines with a single image of an American flag on fire.
Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta said that the Aramco hack was probably the most destructive attack that the private sector has seen to date. How sophisticated was it?
Not. The hackers who've looked at that, including some who've looked at it firsthand, they scorn its technique. They say it wrote over memory 5 or 6 times. And even though it's not sophisticated, the point here is that it worked and that it crossed a really significant line between let's compare it to the DDoS. The DDoS was an attempt to meddle, to make it difficult to do things. This was actual data destruction. This was information sabotage.
And it kind of announces that if they could do this, they could do this to one computer system, they could potentially target any computer system, whether it's government agencies or airports?
That at least is what they were saying in the White House Situation Room when heads of agencies gathered, freaked out about what had happened here. And that's one glimpse that the story offers that hadn't been made public yet.
Well, how long does it take for somebody like Saudi Aramco to recover and put up new protections?
Oh,
are they vulnerable for a while?
Certainly, yes. I mean, let's just keep it to Saudi Aramco. I do know that they are still working on remediation of this months later. But it's important, too, in our discussion of this, to note, Leonard, how much of the information that has been reported about this is itself a kind of information warfare. When Leon Panetta spoke to a group of CEOs at the Intrepid and called it probably the most destructive attack to date, that was a prelude to an Aramco executive coming out and saying that this attack was aimed at Aramco's oil operations, meaning this attack was attempting to make it hard for them to get oil out of the ground. Well, as a matter of fact, that's simply not true. Operations and information technology, sort of your regular garden variety computer use, are kept on completely separate networks at Saudi Aramco. So, and you know, this from, again, people who are actively working on the remediation inside there. So there's a lot of fear-mongering that goes on in this whole discussion, and it's very difficult to slow things down, parse things out, try to understand how much of what's happening is real damage, how much of this is just the big boys puffing up their chests and posturing.
Michael Joseph Gross's article about cyber warfare called Silent War is in the July issue of Vanity Fair. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Michael Joseph Gross, whose article Silent War is in the July issue of Vanity Fair. It's about cyber warfare. How extensive is it? Do we have any sense?
How extensive is it?
I mean, is there something happening at this very moment? Should we assume that somebody is hacking a bank or an oil company or some U.S. government agency or some foreign agency, which is different from what we've been hearing about the NSA collection of data? But would that be included as well?
Oh, unquestionably. Cyber attacks of many kinds are happening on all conceivable fronts, and anybody who has anything that could conceivably be of value in whatever market he works in, for under whatever government he lives under, is going to be a potential target. But again, what I'm trying to do in this story is to tell one discrete narrative about the cluster of attacks that seem to be advancing the interests of one side or the other in the tension between the U.S. and Iran over Iran's nuclear program.
Isn't the code used in these hacks incredibly adaptable? The way you describe how various codes with names like Mosquito and Flame build on each other, it sounds a little bit like the nesting Russian dolls. Is this software easy to adapt and disguise?
For skilled hackers, yes. One of the signal events in this whole conflict was the discovery of Stuxnet a couple of years ago. When that source code was made public, it provided a kind of Rosetta Stone for cybersecurity analysts moving forward, and bits of that code have been found in various other weapons that have since been disclosed, each of which in turn seems to offer another clue that helps to illuminate yet more attacks on various fronts.
Well, Stuxnet was 2007, so I assume since it went after Iran's subterfuges for uranium enrichment, the Iranian government figured out to some degree what that was all about and could then use it, turn it around and use it against the United States.
There's no evidence that Stuxnet itself has been used in that boomerang fashion. Though if memory serves, Stuxnet did begin circulating around 2007. It was not discovered until much later, until after it had done damage. There is one example, however, of the boomerang effect, at least according to the cybersecurity expert Eugene Kaspersky. He believes that Shamoon, the weapon that was used in the Saudi Aramco attack we talked about a couple of minutes ago, Shamoon, he believes, was repurposed as I just switched that around. He believes that Shamoon was repurposed code from an attack that came from either the U.S. or U.S. interests, called Wiper. Wiper, which attacked the Iranian oil ministry and the oil installations on Karg Island. We don't know how much damage it did. We do know that Karg was effectively shut down for a couple of days. So that may be, well, that is certainly one of the early examples of the kind of repurposing that you bring up.
Some people believe that Iran is using Hezbollah and their base in Lebanon to help launch their attacks. Why would Lebanon be a good place to launch a cyber attack from?
Well, according to one Lebanese political operative I spoke with, he said Lebanon is the lungs through which Iran breathes. It provides as a base. It could provide a kind of deniability for Iranian operations. It would be a way, as he put it, for them to answer Stuxnet without having to answer for their own actions. But that's but one of several dramatic but plausible speculations about where these attacks that we believe advance Iranian interests are in fact coming from. Someone else, a very powerful hacker with highly placed sources in the U.S. government, says that as far as he knows, Iran is hiring Russian hackers who are living high, being paid millions, flying in prostitutes from all over.
My guest is Michael Joseph Gross, whose article Silent Wars in the July issue of Vanity Fair. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. On April 23rd, someone hacked the Twitter account of the Associated Press and tweeted that there had been two explosions in the White House and that President Obama had been injured. And then, of course, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 150 points before recovering when people discovered it was a hoax. Could that be something we might be seeing more of in the near future?
Certainly. I mean, what the Qasem attacks on
the group that took credit for it was Syrian Electronic Army.
That's
again, would that be a Hezbollah connection?
Well, so that was the first attack that I know of after the Qasem bank attacks that tried to use these sorts of information operations to cause actual damage to the U.S. financial system. Because Qasem had been the only previous, the Qasem attacks had been the only previous events to cause such damage, it was a conspicuous link. And some people I talked to raised the question of whether there might be some connection between the Syrian Electronic Army and Iranians. It's also possible that the Syrian group just observed what this purportedly Iranian group did and decided to a different kind of copycat.
Well, there have been alliances in that area these days. Syria
certainly
is supported by Hezbollah. Hezbollah supported by Iran.
Certainly.
So the connections are obvious.
And one London analyst did also say that the SEA receives training from Iran. It's also, of course, entirely possible that it was just an oopsie-daisy, that it was just $136 billion mistake. And the fact that we now live in a world where such bulls are loose in our China cabinets is a sobering one.
Well, although
sure,
officials have been reluctant to comment on cyber warfare, there has been some posturing in the media. Iran is reportedly spending $1 billion to build its cyber capabilities. And a general has said that the country has the world's fourth largest cyber army. U.S. officials have said that they have approved a fivefold increase in personnel at the U.S. Cyber Command. So is that meant to reassure us, or is that a different kind of shot across the bow?
There's no way of knowing for sure, because it's not something that our officials will talk about on the record. It does appear, when you create a timeline of these events, that there may be a kind of semi-official tit-for-tat going on, and some of the coincidences are just staggering. For instance, the day that the bank attacks began, the State Department Chief Counsel, Harold Koh, stated that the Obama administration believes the law of war applies to cyber operations, and he emphasized that civilian objects under international law are generally protected from attack. Now, the timing of that announcement on the day that these attacks begin is either a message or surely an extraordinary coincidence.
What is Plan X?
Plan X is a program at DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Association. That would be a
agency.
Bad one. Thank you. That would be a bad one to misremember. Plan X is an attempt to enlist the talents of the best private sector hackers to help defend the U.S.
But isn't hacker culture largely incompatible with military discipline?
Many people think so. And certainly, as one hacker told me, he said we could never work for the government because we could never get high again if we did. So the Pentagon is coming up with, and the NSA are coming up with, new ways of creating kind of almost like Minutemen, you know, bringing the people in who might not be able to, the uniforms might not fit them, but we need their skills.
So instead of AR-15s, our well-armed militia would be people with computer skills. I would assume that the U.S. government is trying to assess and eventually exploit the weaknesses of American products made by Apple, Microsoft, and Google in order to protect the American cyber infrastructure.
Of course.
So they're probing it, and I'm assuming that people in Iran and China and elsewhere also probing those weaknesses.
Absolutely. And let's
And how are those how have those corporations responded?
Well, let's slow down first and just point out why that's so important. The software of Apple, Google, Microsoft, and Adobe, as the ubiquitous software running on all of the most important systems everywhere in the world, those are the doors and windows in every house that the United States government and all governments want to get into. So what they need to do is buy programs called bugs and exploits that can get them through those windows, get them in those doors, and then steal the furniture or move the furniture around. In the last 10 years or so, the United States, Israel, basically every major Western government has devoted increasing money and resources to buying and building these ways into these products. Now, the companies themselves are, well, they're stretched thin trying to keep up with all of the attacks that already come from the bad guys that we know are bad guys without also having to worry about what the supposed good guys are doing behind their backs.
Last week, Bloomberg News reported that as part of the National Security Agency's PRISM program, many technology and software companies are providing sensitive information to the government. They reported that Microsoft provides information to intelligence agencies whenever they release a fix for a bug in their software. Should we be concerned about that level of cooperation between corporations and intelligence agencies?
I think so, absolutely.
And didn't Flame, which was a precursor of Stuxnet, disguise itself as a Windows update?
It did on certain networks. And that was really crossing a Rubicon. That had never happened before. If the United States actually was behind Flame, if the United States essentially used one of the most arguably the most trusted software update system in the world, one that lies at the core of the reliability of the internet, if they use that to spread malicious software, then they've really crossed a line. When you talk to the people in security, they're just as baffled about how to deal with this whole problem as anybody else. And though on the one hand, Microsoft is doing what you just said, Microsoft is also, they're trying to plug the holes, and they are trying, like all of us are trying, to figure out how to do the right thing. Now, the head of security at Microsoft said something to me in this article that I hadn't heard anyone say before, and certainly nobody on his level has called before for an open or an explicit definition of the rules of military espionage. I hope this was something that the president and the president of China spoke about when they got together, to try at least to create, I don't know, the equivalent of Moscow rules for cyber, Moscow rules being the old rules of espionage that gave some dignity to the game of spying in the Cold War. We don't have anything like that now. There are no rules for this game.
Part of Glenn Greenwald's recent reporting on the NSA included a presidential policy directive he obtained, which included that President Obama is said to have ordered national security and intelligence officials to create a list of potential overseas targets for cyber attacks.
Yes.
So we are as engaged in this warfare as any country in the world.
Absolutely. And actually,
people
were
surprised when Snowden revealed that the United States was hacking into Chinese computers, because so far pretty much all the news we've heard has been going the opposite direction.
Yeah, I really believe that if we just sort of cut through all of the noise around this Snowden NSA story, and if we cut through all of the noise in the international relations and the international military game that I'm trying to clarify here, the most important thing that we're discovering, again, there are no rules for the game. And we do what we do because we can do it. We're doing wrong for the sake of doing right. And even though, in a sense, it was always this way, the ubiquity of these vulnerabilities makes it an extremely urgent task, an extremely important goal for the public to press for some definition of these rules. The question of how much of that definition we need to know is another one that we'll need to parse, but the fact that the rules don't exist, that's the problem.
Michael Joseph Gross's article, Silent Wars, in the July issue of Vanity Fair. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you for having me.